Today on Maine Calling, political reporters bring us up to speed on rapidly changing events. For the Maine legislature, the pace is really picking up as lawmakers work to decide hundreds of bills before the end of the session. One of the most important issues before them is a significant shortfall in Maine care funding. Meantime, Representative Laurel Libby this week asked the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn her censure, and several people have already announced their candidacies for statewide races in 2026. I'm Jennifer Rooks. It's a lot to keep up with, so today on Maine Calling, we check in with our political pulse team of Steve Missler and Kevin Miller, plus Susan Cover of Spectrum News. We'll ask about developments in Augusta and the latest on the Trump administration's actions in Maine. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The end of the legislative session is in sight, we think. Today, we'll get an update on what's happening in Augusta, and we will also discuss actions out of Washington that affect Maine. Three journalists join me this hour to discuss what's happening here and in D.C. Susan Cover is the State House reporter and multimedia content producer for Spectrum News. Kevin Miller is Maine Public's State House correspondent, and Steve Missler is Maine Public's chief politics and government correspondent. We invite you to join the conversation, share your thoughts on what's going on in Augusta and what's going on in terms of how Washington and the Trump administration's actions are affecting people here in Maine. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to all of you. Steve, I understand that it is really busy at the State House right now. Bills being passed under the gavel, others coming up at a breakneck pace. Still, there's that big budget shortfall to figure out. Bring us up to speed.
Yeah, so Jen, the Democrats have already passed a budget bill that will fund state government for the fiscal year that begins July 1st. In most of the following fiscal year that begins July 1st of 2026. What they're working on now is that latter part, and they're doing so amid a lot of questions about federal funding and a cloudy revenue picture because of the president's haphazard sort of tariff scheme and its effect on the economy. There's a real mystery about how that's going to affect spending behavior, and which of course affects how much revenue comes into the state. You know, as for the status of those budget discussions, I mean, they don't seem to be going great. I mean, there was a dust up just yesterday on the budget writing committee between Democrats and Republicans over some pretty minor provisions. And because the budget committee does so much of its work behind closed doors, it's really tough to know what else they might be working on to shore up that second year of the biennium. But that's really the focus, I think, of legislative leaders and appropriators right now, is to get that done, because adjournment, as you alluded to in the top here, is in the middle of June, which is coming up pretty quickly. So we'll have to wait and see how that shakes out. It's just tough to sometimes to kind of, you know, see how that those discussions are happening, because so much of it, again, is done out of public view.
And Susan, we mentioned that there are hundreds of bills moving through. Are there any in particular you are watching? Anything that's passed recently that is significant?
Yeah, and this is an interesting bill because it had strong bipartisan support, and actually enough. Should there have been a governor's veto, it would have they would have been able to override it. And it was a bill to direct $3.5 million to kind of shore up public defense services for folks who are sitting in jail right now, accused of crimes, but they don't have an attorney assigned to them to hear their cases. Lawmakers really worked together in a bipartisan way to figure out kind of strategies to get more attorneys in the pipeline and get these folks some legal representation. You know, a judge had ruled that she might start letting people out of jail because the state, for years now, has just perpetually failed to provide constitutionally mandated legal representation. So, you know, as Steve's talking about, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty around a lot of other things, but this was one example where Democrats and Republicans really came together to get something done.
And Susan, this is an issue we've covered here on Maine Calling, the whole issue with the indigence defense system in Maine. I'm wondering that $3.5 million, how is that going to be used? Is that to raise the amount of money that boost the amount of money attorneys are paid to represent people in the system?
I don't think there's more pay raises in this amount. I think it's more finding ways to reach out to get more attorneys into the pipeline to get them then assigned to cases.
Okay. All right. Kevin, of course, all of this is against the backdrop of the Trump administration's anger with Governor Mills. This is hard to keep track of. I'm thinking about, I know that on April 12th, a federal judge ruled that the Trump administration must unfreeze USDA funds, including those for school nutrition programs. So I guess on that question, are the funds coming through? Are schools able to pay for nutrition programs? And then also, the follow-up question is that the last thing, or have other shoes dropped recently?
Yeah, there's just so much going on with this right now, and it's almost to the point where I think everything else we're talking about here, but the State House is getting overshadowed by the fact that this is just coming at us still at a pretty high speed from DC. So on the USDA case, yes, the state filed a lawsuit against the USDA because they had tried to freeze some federal funds for nutrition programs. The judge said, no, you can't do that. From what I understand, checked in with the Department of Education recently, and that money has been unfrozen, so it's flowing again. So that's not an issue. That lawsuit is still hanging out there, and there haven't really been any developments in it yet because they're still in the briefing stage. People are filing their paperwork. The big case, aside from that, is the U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against the Maine Department of Education last month as well. And that lawsuit is basically saying that the Department of Education is violating the non-discrimination law known as Title IX by allowing transgender athletes in girls and women's sports. That case is also still hanging out there. We haven't seen any major developments in it yet, but that's coming. And the really interesting thing here is where that case fits into the broader spectrum of these cases nationwide. This case very well could end up before the U.S. Supreme Court to try to decide this issue on Title IX and transgender athletes. So that's certainly one to watch.
Okay. And speaking of the Supreme Court, oh, Steve, jump in. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add to what Kevin said that you know, he mentioned the possibility of this maybe going to the U.S. Supreme Court. I think it's worth adding that Minnesota just last week filed what they described as a preemptive lawsuit on the Title IX issue because they have a very similar Maine or Human Rights Act that to Maine's, which has allowed transgender athletes to compete on girls' sports teams. And so they're trying to avoid what Maine went through in these, like the yanking of funding and everything else by getting it into the litigation phase right away. And they're hoping that that will kind of prevent some of the retaliatory measures that we have seen over the last few months from the Trump administration. So what the unanswered question to me is how the Minnesota lawsuit might interact with the Maine case. We don't know the answer to that quite yet, but it's something to keep an eye on.
Well, speaking of the Supreme Court, and I'll turn to you, Susan, Representative Laurel Libby has now filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn her censure in the Maine House. Bring us up to speed on that. How did this case get to this point, and what is the likelihood that the Supreme Court hears it?
So in February, Representative Libby had a social media post where she highlighted a photo of a transgender high school athlete. You know, she's making a larger point about her opposition to participation in sports. Democrats in the House voted to censure her, which came along with the loss of her voting rights. She did have the opportunity to apologize, but declined, and then sued House Speaker Ryan Fecteau to try to get her voting rights back. She's so far been unsuccessful in the lower courts. in even temporarily getting her voting rights back while the rest of the case continues to be pending. So this week she said she was appealing to the US Supreme Court to see if they would intervene and give her voting rights back, at least again, while the larger case makes its way through the courts.
Have there been any bills in which the vote was close enough that her vote might have made a difference?
Not that I can recall, but I might defer to Steve and Kevin on that one.
Yeah,
Yeah,
no,
there.
Jen, I don't think so. I mean, there's certainly been some close votes because I think Democrats have, I think it's a 2 or 3 seat edge in the House, which is where Laura Libby, that's where her seat is. But, so far there hasn't been any one vote margins or anything like that that would have been determinative in any bill vote or anything like that so far.
All right. I'm going to look ahead a little bit and talk about 2026. I didn't think this would be happening now, but the fact of the matter is, people have been declaring their candidacy for different offices that are statewide offices. Who wants to go first? What's interesting on this front?
Well,
I'll.
obviously, oh, sorry, go
That's
ahead, Kevin. Go
I
first.
could. Yes, this is Kevin. And obviously, we have a race for governor that's coming up. A Democrat. Shenna Bellows, who our current Secretary of State, she recently announced that she's getting into the race. But we're still hearing lots of other names out there about who else might get into the race. On the Republican side, Bobby Charles is a former, I believe, Assistant U.S. Secretary of State. He has also announced that he's getting into the race, and we've seen a few other names. So the governor's race is the big one, but then I'm sure others may have something to say about the Senate race.
Yeah, I'll jump in. There's been just a couple of note over the last few weeks or maybe months. At this point, it's tough to keep track. I mean, I think the most recent one is this gentleman named Jordan Wood. He's a Lewiston native. And what's interesting, I think, about his candidacy is his connection to Democrats and their fundraising machine. So there's some, and of course, he used to be a chief of staff, I think, for Katie Porter out of California, a congresswoman from California. He got into the race recently, and his, just his connection to fundraising and that sort of thing would seem to suggest that he has at least the potential to organize at least financial support for his candidacy, which I don't think is the case for some of the other candidates that have declared so far. I think it'll be a little bit more of a challenge for them. In terms of him connecting, or having a chance in a Democratic primary, that's just, it's just too soon to tell at this point. And I think the other person who drew some headlines earlier is Philip Wrench. He's running as an independent.
Okay.
And yep, I'm sorry, go
For
ahead.
Senate, for Senate.
For Senate, that's right. I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. These are all for the U.S. Senate seat that is currently held by Susan Collins, and she's up next year. I forgot to thank you for helping me out with that, Jen. But these are the two candidates I just mentioned are folks who have already declared, and they've taken out FEC papers and have candidates campaigns that are active at the moment.
And Susan, I'm going to turn to you and go back to the governor's race because Congressman Jared Golden gets asked all the time if he's running. He told me recently that he has not decided, and he sort of looked at me and said, "Really, I haven't decided." But people have floated other names, Hannah Pingree among them. Is there an advantage for Secretary of State Shenna Bellows declaring this early?
Well, certainly she's out raising money and sending out a lot of emails and generating support. And compared to Pingree and certainly Golden, she needs a little bit more probably help on the statewide name recognition front, although she has been obviously Secretary of State for the entire state. So, and in addition to the names you mentioned, I mean there will be a robust field on both sides. I'm kind of waiting for some of the more notable Republicans to announce and kind of get things going on their end of it too.
Who do you expect to hear from? Who do you think is likely.
I don't really feel comfortable floating names at this point because I'm hearing chatter, but I guess I would say I haven't confirmed with folks directly, so I'm gonna kind of dodge that one, Jen.
Okay, Kevin, what about you? What's your chat, the chatter you're willing to share?
Oh yeah, so there are so many names out there, and I just want to kind of go back to the Senate race, and talk about the one name that we didn't talk about is Governor Janet Mills. So, there's still a lot of rumors out there about whether Governor Mills might get into the race to challenge Senator Collins. Kind of a lot of conversation about whether that really would happen, given, the governor's age and the fact that Collins and Mills have a pretty good working relationship at times. But I think a lot of Democrats are still looking at Mills as maybe being the best candidate to take on Collins this year.
Steve?
Yeah, just to build off what Kevin was saying, I think the attraction for Mills is that she's sort of a hot commodity right now because she's sort of risen up as this resistance figure to the Trump administration. One of a handful, really, when you think about it, at least in the Democratic Party. And so what I've seen some national reporting on this, which is that she's getting some pressure from national Democrats to get involved in the race. And certainly national Democrats are fundraising off of her dispute with the Trump administration. Like every time she says something or has a national TV hit or a press statement or anything, the national Democratic groups are trying to fundraise off of what she's had to say. I'm still and remain unconvinced that she will want to do this. I just haven't She hasn't said anything declarative that would give me the, sense that she really wants to do this, but you never know. You have a lot of people telling you to do it. Maybe that'll change your mind. We'll see.
Let me ask you about, we've seen a lot of citizen protests recently, including yesterday, and I'm wondering if you all think these have an impact on lawmakers.
This is Kevin. I think it's interesting when we've had protests here at the State House during the week, and a lot of the early protests were and rallies were during the week, you would see lawmakers just kind of lingering on the insides of the building watching, but certainly not engaging. But there was interest. The largest rally that we had was a couple of weeks ago, and that's when we had thousands of people here in Augusta and down in Portland. I think that got a lot of attention. I'm not sure how much it's changing the debate. But what I still think is fascinating is the fact that these rallies are still being organized by basically grassroots groups. We're not seeing the parties, the Democratic Party, out there organizing these. And so there's still that question about what the state Democratic and national Democratic parties are doing to push back against President Trump.
All right. Well, we are going to need to take a break. We're talking about politics. What are your questions about what's going on in Augusta or any of the races for 2026 or the Trump administration's actions regarding Maine? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are discussing the latest news from the State House and the White House. With me, Maine Public's Political Pulse team, Kevin Miller, State House correspondent, and Steve Missler, Chief Politics and Government correspondent. Also with us today, Sue Cover, Spectrum News State House reporter and multimedia content producer. If you'd like to share your comments and questions, send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We're joined now by Ryan Fecteau. He is Speaker of the Maine House of Representatives. Speaker Fecteau, thanks so much for calling in.
Great to be with you.
So I'm going to ask you the big questions. What's your priority today? What are you hoping to accomplish in the near term future up at the State House?
Well, we're very busy. The legislative committees have been working very hard to process and hear and work many bills that have been sent to them over the course of the last several months. We're getting sort of close to the end of that part of the process where committees are hearing bills. They're starting to percolate up to both the House and Senate chambers for votes. But ultimately, the focus remains on some of the big issues that Mainers care about. Housing being a big issue. I was actually just talking to the police chief in my community about the struggles she's having with hiring staff and hiring future police officers because they can't find affordable housing in our neck of the woods. And I know that's no that we're not unique in that sense that folks that need staff, need to serve the community and especially public safety, are having more and more challenges finding folks who are both willing to take on the work, but also find a place to live. So housing, childcare, making sure we're meeting our obligation to free school meals, which is important and included in the budget negotiations right now. A lot of issues, but still focus on some of those core issues that are impacting Maine people.
And Speaker Fecteau, you know, you mentioned housing, childcare, free school lunch meals. Meantime, as you know better than anybody, we're facing a budget shortfall. How do you make real progress, especially on housing when it's so expensive, given that?
Yeah, well, I was very excited. A few weeks ago, the Taxation Committee gave a bipartisan vote to a bill that I put forward that would, first and foremost, eliminate the real estate transfer tax for first-time homebuyers participating in the Maine housing program. This will eliminate it for not only the buyer who's participating in that program, but also the seller, so the person selling their home to someone who's participating in that program. I think it might sweeten the pot a little bit, make those loans a little bit more attractive to sellers. So we're really excited that portion of the bill moved forward, as well as a portion of the bill that increases the real estate transfer tax in a rather modest way on the portion of a home sale over $1 million. And there were about 520-ish homes that were listed on Realtor.com just a few weeks ago for over $1 million, several of them, 25, I think, that were over $5 million. And so this is an opportunity to generate a little bit more revenue and for the first time ever have a dedicated revenue source for producing more affordable housing in our state. So this is a landmark piece of legislation, and it was great to see Republicans and Democrats rallying around both eliminating a tax and increasing the tax just slightly in order to build more housing.
All right. Well, Speaker Fecteau, I'm going to turn to Steve Missler for a question. Go ahead, Steve.
Speaker Fecteau, thanks for joining us. I just have a quick question. I'm hoping you can fill us in a little bit about a bill that I saw come across my desk the other day from you, and it's just about ADUs or accessory dwelling units and zoning changes that are associated with that. You were the lead sponsor on a bill that changed some of those requirements a couple of years ago. I'm wondering if you could just describe how this particular bill adds or builds on that particular law.
Yeah, you know, we're trying to make the, you know, a few years ago, we basically passed a law that provided a general allowance for folks who own property to be able to build an accessory dwelling unit on their lot. Oftentimes, you know, those are serving aging parents or kids who are coming home from college and can't find a place to live. So, you know, these are a practical use just to sort of in the family setting. But they also, you know, could be supplemental income for a homeowner too, who just wants to rent it out to the general public. You know, that law was good in the sense that it opened up the door. The challenge is there's still some barriers to the average homeowner to actually be able to build these things. And one of those barriers is a lot of communities have an ownership occupancy requirement, so that the homeowner has to either live in the primary dwelling or in the accessory dwelling. And the practical effect is it limits the person's borrowing, the amount they can borrow from a bank, and therefore limits their ability to actually get the lending they need to build an accessory dwelling unit. So we're trying to attack that issue, as well as a few others in that bill, just to further reduce some of those barriers that are making what is otherwise an allowance that they could do it a bit more realistic and bringing these ADUs actually online for anyone, not just those who have the means and the income and, you know, the wealth to build these things, but just the average homeowner in Maine.
All right, Speaker Fecteau. Thanks so much for calling in and joining us today. I know there's a lot going on up there. That is Speaker of the House, Ryan Fecteau, who is a Democrat from Biddeford. And we are expecting to hear from Billy Bob Falkingham, who is the House Minority Leader, any minute now. So standing by for that. In the meantime, we'll go to Ann calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much. So I'm going to preface this by saying this may sound far out there, but it is in the context of calling from CD2, which has a large border with Canada and which has many members of Gun Owners of America, which makes the NRA look like a gun safety organization. And in the context of President Trump threatening to invade Canada and meanwhile having pardoned violent militia members. That's the context. Maine has a law that prohibits training of unauthorized militias in Maine. Republicans are seeking to repeal that legislation. And I submitted testimony. I don't have the number of the legislation right here. So I have two questions. What is an authorized militia training camp? Is that like the National Guard? And two is, do your experts know anything about where this bill is going?
All right. Great. I know you all are tracking hundreds of bills. Anybody following this one? Go ahead, Kevin Miller.
Yes, so I'll jump in. That bill that passed last year on the question of what is a militia, as I recall, it basically says that it says the only way you can have training is if you are a state recognized militia or like a National Guard. Then you can parade around, you can have in your uniform, you can train with guns. But it was definitely aimed at some of these. There was a neo-Nazi group that was creating a training camp up in northern Penobscot County, and they were very open about this. And so the law would allow the attorney general to go after anybody who was providing paramilitary training for these non-state affiliated groups. There is as the caller mentioned, as Ann mentioned, there is a bill from Republicans that would try to roll back that law. And I believe the last vote that was held on that was a couple weeks ago, and it failed to pass by a very, very narrow margin in the House. So right now the bill is not going anywhere. But that was one of those times where I'm looking at it was 74-72 vote. So if some folks were absent or some folks, didn't vote for whatever reason, that could change. But for right now, I don't think that bill is going anywhere.
Anne, thank you so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email here from Christopher. All that conversation about people who might run for office. What is the sense that Susan Collins is actually going to run for re-election? She always strings it out to commit as long as she can. You mentioned age is a factor for Mills. What about Susan Collins? Has Susan Collins announced, or are people just assuming that she'll be running?
Yeah, this is Steve. I think, she has indicated several times that she plans to run. And, she certainly has a campaign committee that's active and raising money and that sort of thing. But, look, you never know. People can make decisions, Senator Olympia Snowe did back in 2012, I believe it was, where she, everybody thought she was going to seek another term and then announced out of the blue that she didn't want to do that anymore. So you never know. I mean, I haven't seen any indication from Senator Collins that she's thinking that way, but it's certainly a possibility. We just have to, keep close tabs on her and see, but I haven't seen any indication that she's not going to run anything. And I think that's everybody's expectation. I mean, if she didn't, that would be a heck of a story and it would totally scramble everyone's calculation about getting into that race. I think you'd see people that you are more familiar with in Maine politics running against her or running for that seat if she decides to not run. And that includes a lot of Republicans.
So people are making the calculation that they wouldn't be able to beat Senator Collins, whether in a primary or in the general election, that calculation would go away.
Absolutely. Yeah, it would just scramble that entire race.
Kevin? You're jumping.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and kind of that scenario, that's exactly what happened in 2012 when Olympia Snowe was running. She withdrew. And before that, there had been a couple of names out there. But as soon as she withdrew, there was just a flood of people that got into it. And then all of a sudden, we had this former governor who really had people hadn't heard about in a little while, named Angus King, popped up. And he just blew away the rest of the field. So that was totally unexpected. That was nobody was talking about that before Olympia Snowe made that big announcement. But again, to Steve's point, we haven't heard any indication that Collins is going to step away. And she definitely has a campaign that's up and running so far.
All right. Well, on the line with us is now state legislator Billy Bob Falkingham, who is a Republican from Winter Harbor and also House Minority Leader. Representative Falkingham, thank you so much for calling in. Can you hear me?
How you doing?
Oh, there you go. Great. Terrific.
Yes.
Hey,
thanks
for
having me on.
Yeah, I'll ask you the same
question.
It's real
busy down here in Augusta. We're the work sessions and the public hearings are really picking up down here. I mean, I've had 2-3 public hearings, it seems like, every day, and chasing work sessions around. So it's really busy down here.
I understand. Yeah, I've been reading about the hundreds of bills coming through at a breakneck pace. I'll ask you the same question I asked before. I asked the Speaker of the House, what are your priorities right now, today, as you approach the end of the session?
Well, geez, it's hard to keep up with. I mean, of course, we had the big the budget issues go through. That got a little heated up yesterday, but we're still looking forward to fixing this girls' sports issue and protecting our girls. Of course, that's one of our top priorities, something we think we can actually get done down here. We're trying to lower electric rates and just, you know, work for the people of Maine and fix some of the things that are broken and make their lives easier.
All right. Susan Cover, I'm going to turn to our reporter friends here, Billy Bob, and ask Susan Cover to ask you a question.
Yes.
Hi, Representative. You mentioned girls' sports. I know there's several bills in the pipeline. It seems like they've been held for quite a while. Maybe there'll be, you know, one big hearing where a lot of these issues will, you know, get a full public airing. Do you have a sense of when that might be coming up?
So I heard that public hearings are actually going to be coming up on those pretty soon, as early as next week. I don't know as I know that officially, but that's what I've heard. And that's something that we're really looking forward to. Of course, it's become a national issue. I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there. First of all, I just want to say that and I've said this numerous times to people and to media, but we don't have any problem with, you know, saying that people are equal based on their race, sex, color, gender identity. It's just the problem that we have is the interpretation of gender identity. That's basically their interpretation is they're saying that biological boys can compete in girls' sports and go in girls' spaces. And I don't see that as any different as, like, when you say people are equal, which they all are and should all be treated equally, but we don't let 12-year-olds drive a car. We don't let 16-year-olds drink alcohol. There's other certain qualifications where even though you're treated equally, you have to meet certain qualifications. And we just don't believe that biological boys competing in girls' sports meets that qualification because they're biologically different and it creates an unfair advantage. And we believe that the definition of Title IX and the purpose of it when it was passed into law in 1972 was to protect girls, biological girls, to have their opportunities in sports, to have their private spaces, and to have equal opportunities as men. And when you allow people that are biological males to compete in their sports, you're taking away that equal opportunity that was provided to them in Title IX. So, you know, it's not that we have a problem with, you know, gender identity. It's just the interpretation of it. We feel like it's being misused like that. So
sure.
That's an issue we want to address. We want to take care of, you know, we're on the side of the majority of Maine people. Only 29% of Maine people think that biological males should be able to compete in girls' sports, so it's a very small minority.
Representative Falkingham, you know, do you feel as though you have support on both sides of the aisle for this bill or these bills?
I know, as of right now, I know that we do, yes.
Okay.
Which is encouraging.
All right, so as soon as next week?
How much remains to be seen? And whether that will be, you know, continue that way. We don't know what the leadership of the other side will do. We've seen, you know, in issues passed like LD 1619, which was the bill to allow abortion, full-term abortion, very controversial bill, that it looked like that bill was not going to pass, but there was a lot of maneuvering, a lot of pushing from Democrat leadership that got that across the finish line when it otherwise wouldn't have happened.
Well, Representative Fockingham, I really appreciate you taking a few minutes for us today. Representative Billy Bob Fockingham, minority leader for the Maine House of Representatives and a Republican from Winter Harbor. We do need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, politics. My guest, my Maine Public colleagues, Kevin Miller and Steve Missler, our political correspondents, and Sue Cover with Spectrum News. All of them work out of the State House in Augusta. We invite you to join the conversation. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you're super quick, you can get an email in, talk@mainepublic.org. Joining us now is Natalie Emerson, who is a student at Bowdoin College and who, along with fellow student Larson Van Horn, has created a podcast about politics and government in Maine. Thanks so much for calling in, Natalie, and tell us why you decided to create this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having us. Larson's also going to say a quick hello, if that's all right.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Larson.
So we created this podcast. It was born out of just a lot of curiosity, I think, and a lot of frustration at the political divides that we're currently experiencing. It felt like every conversation about politics was angry, and it was hostile, and it was emotionally charged, and it became really exhausting. And so this podcast was a way for us to delve into sort of the mechanics behind how elections work in Maine and how the government functions. And we were able to bring together guests from both sides of the aisle and talk about, just bond over this shared interest of how our system works, regardless of policy disputes. And it was a really neat, it's been a really neat journey to have those conversations and learn about how the government functions.
So what was the biggest surprise to you all?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I personally, one stands out. We interviewed Maine State Auditor Matt Dunlap, and we were asking him about ranked choice voting, and he tied the passing of ranked choice voting in Maine back to Joshua Chamberlain and the Greenback Party, which was fascinating. And then really talking with people, even though the podcast is nonpartisan, Larson and I, of course, have our own political beliefs and had the chance to talk to people on the other side of the aisle, and just found we had a really warm reception from them, and were met with a lot of kindness and curiosity and honesty. And that was really, really neat to see and experience.
Well, tell us how people can listen to your podcast.
Yeah. So our podcast, the first four episodes come out this coming Wednesday, May 7th. The last four will be released on May 17th, and it will be available on the McKean Center website, which is Bowdoin College's McKean Center for the Common Good, and then
Spotify as well. We'll have Spotify, Apple Music, potentially.
Yeah, wherever.
Okay,
you get your
what's
podcast.
It called?
It's called Pine State Politics in Session.
There should be 8 episodes total.
All right. Pine State Politics in Session. Well, thank you all for calling in, and congratulations.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, guys.
Bye. Great. Natalie Emerson and Larson Van Horn, students at Bowdoin, and they have a new podcast about Maine politics. Let's see here. We will go to Lori calling from Deer Isle. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Great show, as usual. I'm wondering if your guests could refresh my memory regarding Susan Collins, what year she first got into office. And I remember her making a pretty strong promise that she was only going to run for, I think she was only going to stay in office for 2 terms. And I'm wondering, how long has she been in? And I'd be interested to know what your guests think of that kind of shenanigans, I guess I'll call it.
Thanks, and Lori. And I do want to know the answer to your question as well. But I will say to you all, if it is true that Senator Collins did say she would only run a certain amount of time, she would not be the first politician to change her mind about that. Right, Kevin?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. She was first elected in 1996. And they're 6-year term, so what would be coming up on our fifth term? I'm not good at math on the air, but yeah, she did, I believe, make a statement at the time that she would only serve 2 terms. But as you pointed out, that's not that uncommon for folks, especially in Congress, to commit to term limits and then change their minds when they get there.
Steve.
And it's also not uncommon for people to bring up that promise that she broke. We hear that, I think, every election, you know, when she's up, that, you know, well, she promised to only run for 2 terms, and that promise was broken a long time ago. So, I don't expect that will go away, that criticism. I'm sure it'll linger for as long as she continues to serve. So.
Thanks, Lori, for your question. We have a related question about Senator Collins, and I think this is a question a lot of people have. An email from JP. Can the panel explain just how much Senator Collins, as head of the Appropriations Committee, can and can't do in response to actions by the administration? Alternatively, how much power does she really have? Big question. Thoughts?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at it. This is Steve. I mean, we often, when we describe the Appropriations Committee, we put this word in front of it, powerful. And that is true, usually, but these are unusual times. And what we've seen in this year, since the President Trump was serving a second term, is that there's been a ceding of that power to the executive branch. I mean, there are levers that the Appropriations Committee can use to exert some pressure on the Trump administration, especially as it goes through and just makes these sort of unilateral cuts to the federal government or to programs that Congress has funded. And there could be hearings to question those actions, and maybe there will be some, but there haven't been any yet. And so I think that's probably where this question comes from, is why not? And that's a good question, but I just don't. I mean, I think the answer is entirely up to the Appropriations Committee chairs, of which Susan Collins is the lead chair. And we have asked if she's going to, you know, for example, ask for testimony from Elon Musk, for example, or any of his associates, and some of the moves that they've been making throughout the federal government, this sort of hoovering up of personal data, and which has caused a lot of concerns for a lot of people. And I think, you know, that what we've heard, and maybe Kevin can speak to this because I think he asked this question more recently, but is those are a possibility, but I don't know that we have any definitive date as to when that might happen.
Yeah, we did see the first Senate Appropriations Committee full hearing happen just this week. So they've been in session since January, and they've held their first full meeting this week, and it was on biomedical research. And there were a lot of concerns. This is a top concern for Senator Collins, and it's a bipartisan concern because of the cuts that have been made to NIH and to research grants and what kind of impact that would have on research facilities around the country, including here in Maine. The hearing involved biomedical researchers and a parent of a daughter who had cancer. There was nobody from the Trump administration there. What we heard from Senator Collins' office is that they will be called to testify at a later date, but they haven't said when that's going to happen. So kind of to Steve's point and the writer's point, there's just a lot of questions about when Republicans are going to start pushing back on this control of the purse strings that Congress has always had and try to take it back from the Trump administration.
We'll go to Emery, who's calling from Waldo County. Hi, Emery. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to respond to Billy Bob Buckingham's comments regarding protecting girls and women's sports. I was once a young girl who played women's sports, and I was a swimmer. I presented as quite a masculine young girl. I had short hair. And I just want to encourage folks who are listening to think about how these bills will actually be implicated in our schools. What will need to happen to check that young girls are cisgender girls versus transgender girls? It does not make young girls safer to have to question, to be frank, what their body parts are and to go through the process of implicating whether or not girls are cisgender or transgender. I also would like to speak to his comments regarding, you know, kids that are 12 aren't yet able to vote or aren't yet able to, you know, be in the military, for example. When we're talking about gender-affirming care, hormone replacement therapy, we are talking about medical care for young kids that has been through a medical system for many years. People do not become transgender overnight. And I want to encourage folks to think about medical privacy and the really thoughtful and long process that parents and families and children go through in determining whether or not kids are eligible for gender-affirming care. Myself, as a member of the LGBTQ community, I think it's important that we remind ourselves that this has never been about protecting young girls. This is about putting transgender people in the silos and in the margins of society and not having access to something that should just be a fun and extracurricular activity such as sports. So yeah. I would encourage all folks to look at this bill thoroughly and understand.
Oh, gosh, Emery, we're starting to lose you right there, but really brought up some important points. I'm sure these points will be brought up again next week during the public hearings, if this is indeed when those public hearings are. But that is one of the big questions, isn't it? What Emery started with was, if one of these bills is passed, then what? How do we check?
Right.
Are we asking schools to ask children to take off their clothes? I mean, it's a very practical question.
Yeah, and to your point, Jen, and the caller's point too. I think that's a real sticking point in some of these bills. I mean, there's several of them. There's not just one floating out there, and I think the devil is in the details of those. Just to address some of the, I mean, to address some of the points that the caller made, I think that's a concern, and especially from the LGBTQ community and the trans rights folks too. I think they're very concerned about that, and you know, we'll have to see how they how the lawmakers navigate those worries, especially given the politics of this thing.
Emery, thank you so much for your call. And I want to ask my guests here today, the reporters here today, Billy Bob Falkingham seems to believe that there is support on both sides of the aisle for a bill that would address transgender girls in sports. And I'm wondering if you all think that he's right. Is there indeed enough bipartisan support that a bill will likely pass this session?
Go ahead, Kevin. Sorry.
Oh, no. I would say, you know, it's tough to tell right now. He's right. The polling suggests that the majority of not only Americans, but Maine residents don't support allowing transgender athletes to participate in girls and women's sports. So I think there is going to be pressure on Democrats in the legislature to change what we have. We have our Civil Rights Act in the state, which says gender identity is a protected group. So there's going to be pressure. I'm not sure. And I no doubt there are members of the Democratic caucus who feel that way. The question is, Democratic leadership does not seem interested at this point in changing that. So how much pressure can they put on their members to keep from changing the law? I guess that's one thing I'd say.
I think the other thing to consider here too, this is just jumping in again, I'm sorry, is how this would affect the litigation. Right. If you change the law, do you undercut the litigation, your case in court? And so I think that's a key component here to consider as we you know, look at these bills next week and how they might fare in the full legislature.
Might someone else argue, though, Steve, if we change, you're saying how it affects what happens in the court. Somebody else might say if we change this law, maybe then the Trump administration would leave Maine alone.
It might. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one argument to make. I guess the question is are the people that are fighting the Trump administration right now willing to take that loss?
Got you. And on a related point, we have an email here from Katina. When asked what his focus was in Maine Congress, I'll correct her and say Maine legislature, he went on about the handful of transgender children playing in girls' sports. Is this really the most important aspect of Mainers' lives that needs attention? People are hungry and need affordable housing. And so I think that many people agree with Katina. I'm not going to have you all respond because we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. The voice you just heard, Steve Missler, Maine Public's chief politics and government correspondent, Kevin Miller, Maine Public's State House correspondent, and also Sue Cover, State House reporter and multimedia content producer for Spectrum News. Today's sound engineer, Jess Miller. Our theme music composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Go find our newsletter at mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.